Hi, you're listening to the Fast Leadership Show with your host, Gordon Treadgold. And on today's show, we're going to be talking about how to become a conscious leader. We need to be able to lead ourselves. We need to understand ourselves better. And we need to look to lead deliberately and with purpose. And on today's show, we're going to be talking to Rosalie Chamberlain, who is the author of Conscious Leadership in the Workplace, a guidebook to making a difference, one person at a time. So welcome to the show, Rosalie.
Hello. Hey, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure. I really enjoyed your book. I got a great deal. A lot of the things about conscious leadership, it's, you know, you're actually mentioning it in the book, and we were just talking about before we came on air. It is actually quite a long journey, and no matter how far you think you're already down it, there's still a lot further to go. So I got a lot out of the book, and it reminded me of a lot of things that I started to do and should do more of.
Well, thank you, and that means a lot because I know you have written a lot of books and articles and worked with a lot of people, and for you to still be able to get something out of it, I think that's fantastic because I get something out of it almost every day.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, one of the things I found about it was there was quite a lot of academic detail into it. So some of the times I think about things and I do them, but I'm not really, I couldn't tell you the science behind it or, you know, be able to articulate it better. But having read your book, there was a lot of things that I was like, okay, so that's what they call that. Okay, now I can understand, you know, things like the unconscious bias. That's not a phrase I use an awful lot. But actually, as I read through that chapter, I realized it was something that I actually suffered from quite a lot and needed to do more work on.
It's a topic that I work with a lot of organizations and individuals with, and we all have biases, and it's not really a question of if we do, it's which ones are ours and how are they impacting our decisions.
Yeah, and so, as I say, it was good to be able to put a name and a label to some of these things because, you know, the more we understand, the better positioned we are. And what I liked about your book was you started it with my favorite quote on leadership from John Quincy Adams, the, you know, if your actions inspire others to do more, be more, strive for more, then you are a leader. Because I absolutely believe that and that leadership is about action. And you talk about that a lot in the book. So what do you think? How do you define leadership?
Leadership is, first of all, it comes from within. It's not something that someone else confers upon you. It's how you lead, and whether you're leading your life, whether you're leading an organization, a family, a culture, a team, a country, we're all leaders in some form. So it's how effective we are we leading that journey. Are we inspiring others? Are we inspiring ourselves? Are we focusing on, there are many, many characteristics I outline in the book that have to do with openness and communication, but it's really, is this something that is coming from inside you because you are committed to be able to give your best?
Yeah.
And be your best and help others be their best?
Yeah, it was interesting. I read through the list of characteristics, and I agree with you. A lot of leaders have those characteristics, but just having those characteristics don't make you a leader if you actually don't choose to do anything with them. You know, it's a verb, not a noun. It requires action, as John Quincy Adams mentions.
Right.
So when you talk about conscious leadership, can you tell us a little bit more about what you mean by that?
Certainly. Conscious leadership or consciousness is just being self-aware. It's being aware of how you show up as a leader. Are you taking action? Are you exhibiting integrity and honesty? And are you really paying attention to what it is you are trying to achieve? So you are able to know where you want to go, what that goal is, and understand where you are, and to come up with a type of strategy or steps or behaviors that you need to take on to get there.
So that's conscious leadership. It's about being self-aware and kind of leading on purpose. Would that be a way to say it?
That's a really good way to say it, leading on purpose.
Because I think what I found interesting in that first chapter was, you know, there's an awful lot of, you know, we talk about branding and people think of branding as creating a logo, a letterhead, but actually our brand is defined through our actions. And you talk a lot about that in, you know, what's the message that you're broadcasting? Are you, you know, and are you coming across as a leader? Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, the importance of that and some of the pitfalls that we could fall into?
Certainly. We're actually broadcasting, quote unquote, messages all the time, every day. And whether we're aware of what we're, quote unquote, saying, it's still being said. So our behaviors, our verbal and nonverbal actions and words are definitely being received by others. And while there's a certain amount of responsibility in how one takes in information and then projects that information, it still has impact. I used to struggle with the idea that perception is the truth.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's somebody's perception is based on their own filters.
Yeah.
And so the way I have worked this out is kind of by the tagline of my book. It's how you make a difference one person at a time. It's that individual responsibility. You cannot really determine how someone will receive your message, but it's your responsibility to be clear about the message. So if it is not understood, it's not blaming someone else by saying, well, they didn't get me or they didn't understand me. It's how can I get my message across in a clear way?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I work with a very good speaker and communication trainer. In fact, he's one of the leading experts on communication in the world, a guy called Nick Boothman. He wrote How to Get People to Like You in 90 Seconds or Less. And he said he was approached by a client and they said, look, I want you to come and coach my team because they don't understand anything that I'm saying. And he said, okay, but it's not your team that I need to be coaching. how people respond is an indication of the quality of your communication. It's not about their reception. It's about the messages that you're sending. And he said the gentleman in question got extremely disgruntled and said to him, well, if that's your opinion, I'll find somebody who will coach my team. And you just look at that and you think, you've got zero chance of improving.
Well, maybe you should read my book.
You know, completely self. It's interesting. I was thinking as I was reading the book, being self-aware is, I like that as a term, but I also think that there's more to it than just being self-aware. You actually need to be aware of others. And that term, and I'm not saying it's your term, it's the general term. I think it misses something by not conveying that. We need to be aware of ourselves, but we also need to be aware of others and our impact upon them. Because I think if you're somebody who's not self-aware and you hear that term, you might just go away and learn all about yourself and completely miss the point of empathy and emotional intelligence.
Right. Emotional intelligence is a very key factor to being an effective leader, I believe.
Oh, absolutely. No empathy, no connection. And it's all about the connections that we make. So what do you think are some of the benefits of a lead for a leader who can actually find, be that conscious and project the kind of leader that they want to be?
To begin with, I believe they're more content with themselves. So many times I heard people say that they wanted more out of their job or what they were doing or how they were leading their career or their team. And when the focus was on being aware of how effectively they were leading and how they could be more effective, paying attention to being more aware of others and aware of the messages that they send out with their either verbal or nonverbal, or the way they make decisions and how inclusive they are, they're more content. So I believe that's one. Number two, I would say it's an excellent role model for someone else to be able to have the courage to look at their own career or their own life or their own way that they're living. It's the ability to be vulnerable, the ability to grow, having a growth mindset. And when this happens and the team is on board and it feels like they are valued and can contribute, the leader and the organization has a much better opportunity to leverage all of the talents and unique skills that are hired into the organization.
I agree with you. I think having worked in leadership positions for 25 years and been on that journey, I think once you do get through to that consciousness, it allows you to go from me and you to we. You can, I know we're going to talk about this a little bit later. You can just let go of that ego. You don't have to. I think when we initially take on leadership roles, it's like, oh, I'm a leader, and I put a hat on, I create a little bit of distance, and then I follow processes which allow us to get things done, but they actually don't create cohesion between the leader and the team. It creates a little bit of distance, and you kind of have to let that go. I think, I'm just, trying to articulate it now as I think about it, and kind of just trust who you are, and be a leader rather than maybe following processes that you've been taught as, this is how leaders should be, and you just be yourself, fly without a net, as it were, and become, part of the, create a team of which you are a part rather than you're separate from, if that makes sense.
It makes total sense to me, and I definitely agree with you that being able to be authentic and being able to be part of the team instead of over the team, it's that internal benefit of the inner strength that keeps growing, and that the team also has the ability to do that too. So you're collaborating together, you're creating together, you're really making a difference toward the outcome that you want to achieve.
I think I'm just thinking about this. I was wondering why that happens, and I was just wondering whether, for me personally, I'm a very, I was always a head down in charge, follow me kind of person. And I think I was just wondering whether that it served me tremendously well, that be the leader that sets the example and leads the charge. But once you start managing of a certain scale, you can't do that. You actually have to delegate down and trust your team and let them take that charge. So you kind of lead from the back rather than lead from the front. Because once you're managing an organization of a particular size, it's impossible to lead from the front because you become a limitation. So I'm just wondering whether we're kind of trained to go one way and then we just have to take that step back and kind of lead from the back and hand it over to the team. Well, I know that was an awful lot. What's your thought on that?
Well, it's a great thought, and I find myself nodding in agreement. Yes, and what I'm thinking is that we, as a leader, it want to contribute. The people we lead want to contribute, and as you move toward a larger scale of leadership, so where you do need to delegate and you do need to lead from the back, the ability to do that and means that you're allowing others to contribute. So that just brings that much more talent and skill. That brings that much more collaboration. And as long as you're honestly walking this talk to be able to inspire, motivate, and help others create, you're still creating too.
Yeah, I think again, just thinking about it, because as I said, we talked about this before we came on, that this is a journey. You've never mastered this.
I agree.
The more you think you know about yourself, the less you've just proven you actually know. And I was just thinking about it, and I think we have to get comfortable. And I know we're going to talk about ego a little bit, and we kind of have to get comfortable with reflected glory rather than direct glory. It's no longer about us scoring the winning touchdown or taking the winning shot. It's about reflected glory from having a master team that do things, and we kind of have to let go of that, and that can be tremendously difficult to do if you've always been somebody who's being in the thick of it and led from the front and given that final push to success.
I agree, and I think that's part of the journey to be able to do that. It might take some transition if you've been in the middle of everything and then all of a sudden you're in a more hands-off position. But if you are really focusing on knowing that that is what's best, it's what you want to achieve, you're aware of your own push-pull, I guess,
Yeah.
or decision, and then you learn to work with that and keep moving forward.
Well,
Instead of being
I think from my experience, as I mentioned a little bit before, you can achieve so much more when you're not doing anything. If everything has to go through your hands, you're limited to what you can achieve. And you can get more done and make a bigger impact by taking your hands off and letting others do it.
And you get a, I believe you get a much better outcome because you need a significant amount of perspective and ability and experience and different skills and unique abilities coming together to create whatever it is you want to create, whether it's a product or a service or a company.
Yeah, and I think technology changes so quickly as well. To be that frontline troop, it's difficult to keep up with the technology. You're actually better off learning about leadership because leadership never changes. You're just applying it. You just get better at applying it. And I know for me, I worked in IT. I mean, the technology is a complete mystery to me. I started 25 years ago. When I started programming, we were programming in COBOL. I mean, if you ask developers today, they would just look at COBOL. What the hell is that? But once you manage leadership, those skills don't change. They've been the same for the last 2,000 to 5,000 years. So it gives you a little bit more longevity, but it does require you to let go. And one of the things you talk about in the chapter two of the book is that element of fear and why people are reluctant to take this journey. I know if you've always been the expert, to actually step back and leave it to somebody else can be very fearful. But can we talk about fear? What's your thought on that? And how do people get past it?
I believe that fear has an element in anything that blocks or excludes or, and it doesn't, we think about fear in the standpoint of being really, really afraid.
Yeah.
It's not always really, really afraid. It's a tendency to fight or flight, to defend, or you could be defensive of your stance, defensive of your leadership style, defensive of your product. That is the type of fear, because you're so attached to an outcome that makes you think you will be safe. And when that is happening, I don't believe you're giving your best, or you're open to other possibilities. And you may be, I have an acronym that F, of course, is fight or flight, and then, you know, E, it means that you're excluding something. Maybe you're excluding possibilities, or you're separating up from others, or maybe you're just isolating part of your own understanding of why are you worried about this? Why are you afraid to speak up? Why are you afraid to let go and let someone else run the show? So different ways it can show up. So when you are doing this, you really are avoiding a lot of situations or people or possibilities. And most of this is coming from some sort of a reaction. It's an emotional reaction when we get triggered to be either in fight or flight, which could be withdrawing or defending.
Yeah.
So fear is the best way is to admit, I have fear. And that's okay. And what is it? Why? What is that my concern? What am I afraid of? What to start asking those questions, or even get the assistance of someone to help you get rid of any sort of distortion or generalization or belief that you are holding on to so tightly that you're squelching possibilities.
Yeah, what's interesting with fear is that I when I first started doing public speaking, I didn't like it, and you know, I had a lot of nervousness. You know, I was afraid to speak, and I actually spent a lot of time trying to quash that fear. But actually, what I found was that if I got rid of those butterflies in my stomach, my talk was dull, flat, unemotional, uninteresting. If I could actually accept that fear and actually hold, you know, kind of ride it, I gave a much more passionate presentation, because a lot of the fear was because I cared about what I was talking about, and I was afraid that people, you know, might not be interested or get a lot out of it. And actually embracing that fear, and it took me a long time because I kept trying to push it away, and pushing it away actually caused what I didn't want to happen, which was I gave dull presentations. Whereas now I'm more worried if I don't feel a little bit afraid when I go to speak, because it kind of feels like you don't care about this.
You make a very interesting point, which I would define as saying that what fear is energy.
Yeah.
So you can let the fear take over and be more of a negative energy, sort of a catabolic, destructive energy.
Yeah.
Or you can let it be a very empowering energy that juices you up, that you're transforming it. You're transforming it into something that you're excited about, but you're not doing it from a place of being scared or attached to what if they don't like me or what if I don't do a good job. You are connected to your passion, and that turns that energy into something very powerful.
Yeah, I think it's kind of, you know, taking the fear and not becoming afraid, using it as a positive. And one of the other things I'm always interested with fear, and I experience both of these, and I find it completely bizarre and completely irrational, and that is that some days I put things off because of a fear of failure. And then other days I put them off because I have a fear of success. And that kind of, it almost seems crazy that we would be afraid of being successful. I look at that and I can understand fear of failure because I put all the effort in and it hasn't worked out. But, you know, the fear of success, that is something I suffer from it every now and again, and I just can't wrap my head around it, why I would have that.
Well, it's an interesting concept, and when you think about it, and one of the things I do is coach individuals, and when they're talking about the fear of success, one of the first questions I would ask is, so what does success mean to you? And start peeling away, what are the beliefs you hold? If I have success, then this. And so there are all of these beliefs an individual might hold, and they could be, well, I won't have enough time to do everything, or either I'll be too busy, or I will lose friends. So there, it's almost like there's some other competing agreement that they've made to stay small, or where they are. It may not be small. It may be, I'm doing okay. But there again, we're still talking about beliefs, because if you do become more successful and you have more opportunities, if the belief is, I can't manage all of that, then a new belief might be, what resources will I need then to help me manage that? Maybe that's when you hire more people or you delegate more. So it's less, maybe, I'm just thinking this, maybe it's less a fear of what to do with success than it is of the actual success.
I think as we talk about it, I think one of the things now that occurs to me is that I think there's a lot more responsibility that comes with success than comes with failure. Because often sometimes when you try something and fail, it's kind of over. But as you say, if you succeed with it, now you've got to, you move forward. And it might be, for me, it might just be the thought that, you know, if you give one successful talk, you can't just stop. Now you've got to go. Now you've got to keep going and doing it again and again. And can you maintain so that it's maybe a fear of failure that's going to come up after the success? Because I'm not convinced I could be successful every single time. Where, you know, if I just fail now, I can just bow out gracefully. Whereas if I'm successful, I might have to do this again and fail on an even bigger scale. I mean, one of the things that always, when I read books like yours and we have these kind of conversations, the one thing that I'm always amazed by, and that's just how powerful our mind is, and the control it has over us, and the games and tricks it plays with us. It's truly an amazing tool, and if we can get it working in our favor, we can be unstoppable. If we can't get it working in our favor, we're almost unstartable.
That, you're very right. Our minds are incredibly powerful, and we take in so much information, and it doesn't even know what's true and what's not true. So if you take in a belief that says, well, I can't sustain having a good speaking opportunity, speaking each time, then that's, your mind might determine it wants to believe that. So that's where this, another piece of the self-awareness and consciousness comes in.
And I think it's, the whole ego as well creeps in as well. You know, that, maybe I just believed I was lucky and I couldn't repeat it. I don't know. So I wanted to talk about the unconscious biases and understanding of them. Could you give us an example of an unconscious bias that a leader might have that can stop him from becoming acting with authenticity as a conscious leader?
Oh, yes, there actually are many. And the key is to make an unconscious bias conscious. So let's take the example of gender equality in an organization. So if the statement or the mission of the organization is to be open and inclusive and equal opportunity, that's great. If the women or some women are not given the same opportunities, the question is why, especially if on paper everyone is equally qualified. And some of the biases that I've seen, so to give you an example, is the bias that without thinking about it, and consciously you may think, oh, I don't believe this, but unconsciously believing that, well, women won't have the same amount of time to devote because of family commitments. Now, once you bring that conscious, you can say, well, that's not true. Let's say this particular person is actually as committed and as hardworking as everybody else. But until you make that connection, you might not be choosing someone because there's this belief, that's what a bias is, it's an attitude or a belief that they won't have the same ability or the time. And I've actually seen this happen where the individual actually believes, well, we don't want to, this is the best, we want the woman to have more time with the family. That may not be what she wants.
Well,
So to be aware.
it's funny you say that, because one of the examples that I saw was exactly that. A lady was overlooked for promotion, and I mean, she was very, very capable. She was a good friend of mine, a good colleague. I got on very well with her, and she got a little bit emotional when she didn't get the promotion, and she decided that she was going to quit. And she ended up quitting the company. We had a leaving do for her, and after the leaving do, I was chatting with my boss, and I said, it's a shame that she's left. And he said, yeah, but it's also a blessing in disguise, because it's now going to give her the opportunity to spend more time with her children. I mean,
Bingo.
this wasn't a job, and I thought, that's not your concern. Not our job. It's not our job to, give women the opportunity. I mean, she had two small children. I think they were 3 and 5, something like that. But her mother acted as a nanny for them, and that was, she wanted to be a professional woman. That's just not how he saw things. And
Right. And it's interesting because we may have a positive intent. That might have been a very positive intent for him to believe that way, but
absolutely.
it doesn't equal the impact that it had on her and her career. So
Correct.
that's a very important piece about biases, because we can have bias for something or bias against something. And our intent may be very positive, but we have to be able to consider the impact on others, not just what we believe it would be.
Yeah, I mean, and sometimes asking them, what do you want? Is this okay? Rather than making the decision for them that they'd rather be at home looking after children than working. I mean, that's just not our call, that's their call, and we should
Right.
support that.
It's also another interesting thing about biases. Often we think about biases that we have biases about other people or other situations or other events, but we have biases about ourselves as well. Let's take your example of the public speaking. If they're thinking again that a bias is a belief or an attitude, that a belief is, I can't always deliver a dynamic speech, then that's a belief that might not be serving you very well.
Correct.
So, or there might be a bias about, well, I'm not at a certain level in an organization, so I don't need to speak up because I don't have any clout, or they won't listen to me. There again, that's a bias about yourself and someone else. It's a bias that what you have is not, maybe not worth considering. It could be that is a bias, or also that they won't listen. So there again, you're imposing a judgment on someone else.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, because I had exactly this conversation with my wife yesterday, and I think if she'd have been a bit closer, she would have slapped me. and it's that, you know, I'm 5'6", and I'm about 185 pounds, and I've always been, my perception, my bias is that, you know, for my height and size, unless I'm wearing a suit, I don't look smart. I just, uh-huh. You know, and I'm one of these people, I'm like, you remember Pigpen in Charlie Brown, always with flies buzzing around them. You know, I could spend an hour in a sterile room and find a way to get a stain on a white shirt. Whereas my brother, you know, he was 3 or 4 inches taller than me, and it didn't matter what he wear or whether he ran through hedges backwards and forwards, he always looked really, really smart. And my wife just said to me, "That's just your thinking. It's not true. Get that thought out of your mind." And then she said, "How is that serving you?" And I said, "Well, it does allow me to be scruffy and not be too bothered about it."
That's a great example. It's a great example.
But yeah, it's, you know, as you say, our minds are a powerful thing, and sometimes, you know, the question is, how does that serve me? Is that serving me in a greater way that I'm unconscious of, and why I'm reluctant to let that go? I don't know the answer to that. Maybe it's when people tell me, "Oh, you're not smart," I can say, "Oh, yeah, that's okay. I never look smart." I don't know. It's an interesting.
And I think it's another opportunity to question what's the story you're telling yourself?
Yeah.
So if then you are going to fret whether or not you look smart enough for an event, and you're fretting, it's going to impact your behavior. But if you've said, "Okay, I'm worried about whether I look smart enough, and now I realize that this will be fine," then you can let it go and you can move forward.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always smart enough because I wear a suit, you know, because I kind of have that. And again, this might be wrong. You know, I feel I look smart in a suit. So if I want to look smart, I wear a suit. I just have this belief that if I'm not wearing a suit, I don't at all. So I have a solution for it. But as I say, you know, as you said, we build these biases and unconscious biases that, you know, who knows why we've got them. And if we don't understand them, we can, it doesn't allow us to have that, you know, to be as self-aware as we should do, and then sometimes make the right decisions.
Right. And the interesting thing is that we don't necessarily always know, without giving it some conscious thought, where we got the biases. Many of them we were taught very strongly how to believe, who to be with, who not to be with, how to act, what roles are. And then we also get a lot of subliminal messages, and some of them are pretty subtle and some of them are pretty blatant, through the media, through television, through so many different ways. And to begin to stop and look at, what is the truth? What do I believe? I was actually brought up in the South, in the United States, in Georgia.
Yeah.
I live in Denver now. And
live where now?
I live in Denver, Colorado now. And I was taught as a little girl in the South in the 50s and 60s, many, many prejudices and stereotypes, different types of isms about gender and race and religion. And that's all I was taught.
Yeah.
No one told me differently. So my own commitment to some inner passion for finding equality inside me and in the world led me on a journey. And one of the types of consulting I do with organizations is about diversity and inclusion.
Yeah.
If I had not challenged those biases in the teachings that I was taught,
yeah,
I wouldn't be doing the work that I do now.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think my background is completely different to yours, I would imagine. I'm somebody who's completely at ease with diversity because the school I went to, we had 35% Asian and Afro-Caribbean. I used to go to a youth club where I was the only non-Afro-Caribbean person in that youth club and played sport. I played cricket and I was the only, we were called the Caribbean Kings, and I was the only non-Afro-Caribbean. So when I get to companies and I look at, and I struggle sometimes to understand why people have are not as diversity comfortable as I am, but it's because I've never known anything differently. So yeah,
right.
My bias is to be, you know, to be in a minority, to have openness and to, you know, use the best that's available. And I try not to be too judgmental with people that come from a different, you know, because it is an education and we can't criticize them for the education they've received. We can only look to try to re-educate them and help them see a different and what I believe a better way forward.
Absolutely. You know, you bring up something that remind me, and I offer this to clients all the time, and it's in my book, is that try having a judgment journal. And now whether or not you have a little booklet that you fill it out or you just sort of run it through your mind, every time that you make a judgment about someone else or yourself, how fast will you fill it up?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because, you know, whilst I'm culturally diverse, I still have those biases because I played sport with a lot of Afro-Caribbeans. Every time I now see a black athlete, I always expect them to be incredibly fast runners.
Right.
So it's a bias that's pro in terms of it's not – well, I guess it's racist because I'm seeing one race as better than another, but it's a bias that comes from a different place. And, you know, having played rugby, you know, everybody, you know, it's the players that are the most skillful. There's not necessarily a one particular group that has all that talent. But, you know, that was a subconscious bias. If I had to mark, you know, somebody from the Afro-Caribbean, I almost always knew they were going to be a lot faster runners than I was, even though I had no proof that was the truth at all.
Then that's a great example of the assumptions that we make.
Yeah.
Yes, based on our experiences. And
And as you say, it can actually cause us to make incorrect decisions. Because that bias might not be true. I mean, it was in my case, and it had nothing to do with skin color. I was just ridiculously slow. It didn't matter who I was against; they were always faster than me. But you know, if I'd have been faster, it could have caused me to maybe not take opportunities that I would have said, "Oh, I'm not good enough for that. Somebody's going to be better than me," and then I'm losing out because of not only can subconscious biases stop us giving other people opportunities, they can actually, you know, limit our own progress because we think, oh, I'm not good enough now. You know, these people are better than me or that, you know, people from that education. I mean, again, one of the biases that I had, I came from the north of England. I have a Yorkshire accent. And, you know, I always felt I wasn't as good as people that I went to Oxford and Cambridge. That spoke with that kind of, you know, who spoke good Queen's English, and that took me a lot of time to get beyond that.
These are great examples.
I'm not sure whether this is an interview or a therapy session now. So let's talk about Triggers.
Triggers. Triggers are those things that cause these biases to pop to the surface, even if we don't see them, or they cause us to have the fears. They show up in different ways. They're just these automatic messages that pop in and usually show up in some sort of a reaction, often an emotional reaction. And you may some examples could be that your body, you have sweaty palms, or you get nervous or anxious, or you get argumentative, or feel guilty, or withdraw, or take sides. So any of these things that are beginning to, which actually leads into the next chapter of the either or, that this is happening and this is my reaction, and something, you're off center. You're not back to your connecting to your really being able to analyze and make a very conscious decision. You're just automatically reaction is when you are triggered by something and one of these automatic messages takes hold.
So this is when we're triggered by emotion rather than by logic and facts.
Correct. So if you go back to the fight or flight, the fear idea, and your emotions are such that you're nervous or fearful about making the speech, and you either choose to let that energy propel you or flatten out to try to calm you down, or you decide, oh, I'll never do this again. So you're doing this flight or fight thing. If it's really fear, I mean, it's rare that we have a situation that is truly life or death.
Especially in the
And
speaking business.
yes, and if it, but if it is, that's not just an emotional reaction. That is, it's just different. And the emotions are the things that you feel that tell you something is going to be a certain way.
And again, when we talk about speaking, one of the things that when I have to speak, I do have that trigger that makes me sweating. I get very nervous, and it even allows me to overlook the fact that I always get great feedback on this talk. There's one talk I
Okay.
do, and I always get great feedback. Yet whenever I have to give it before I go on, I'm always. And if somebody was to come to me and say, you know what? We're behind schedule. Do you mind if we cut your talk? I would probably get down on my knees and thank the Lord and go, oh yes, I'll volunteer not to give it. Even though the feedback, even though the facts
The truth.
prove that I actually do that talk well and that people like it, yet my trigger, my fear is, it's, as you say, it's sweaty palms, it's it's not a good look.
I can appreciate the feeling. We get in our own way sometimes, and that happens when we get triggered, and something inside us tells this is not safe.
And I say, even in the face of overwhelming data to the contrary, if emotionally we don't feel good about it, we can just discard that. We can just discard that data and become emotional and not logical.
Right. And the idea to, if you feel triggered, a really good question to do is like, what am I afraid of?
What could go wrong?
Right. So it's a good way to track once you're aware of what those triggers are when they're popping in.
And you said that these triggers can lead us into duality, yes, no situations. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Sure. We're often thinking that something's either good or bad, either or, right or wrong, this or that. And I call that dualistic thinking. And it means that, well, what happens is if it's either this way or that way, you've got a lot of different possibilities and potentiality. So if you think that there are only two choices, then the opportunity to maybe have more perspectives at the table is pretty much squelched. So I like both and thinking. So if we took speaking again, it's, let's say, it's scary or it feels completely natural.
Yeah.
Well, what if it's a little bit of both?
Yeah.
So because if you're staying with scary all the time, then you might not go through with it.
Yeah.
If it's completely natural, you might not be given. Sometimes that scary piece makes you work a little harder to make sure you're doing your best.
Yeah, do the preparation, yeah.
Exactly. So if it's both, then it's something to be able to realize, okay, I can accept both. But either or, especially if we're thinking about, let's take it back to an organization and individuals, and we're coming up with an idea for a solution to a problem, and it's either this way or that, well, that may not be the only case. There may be other opportunities.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I think sometimes with leadership, and I struggled with this for a while, but then as I got more of that self-aware, there was my way and there was other ways.
Mm-hmm.
And because I've been successful doing a lot of things, it was my way or wrong. And, it took a long time to actually, these people are just as knowledgeable as I am. There's more than one way of skinning the cat. If they can get their way to work, then let them. Because the last thing I want is somebody to ask me to do a job that I'm capable of and then tell me to do it their way. I want them to let me do it my way. And
when you allow the others to give their input and give suggestions, you've got loyal employees who feel like they're valued and are included.
Yeah, because one of the things that you mentioned in the book that I really resonate with, and that is, are you a leader that you'd like to work for?
Right.
And it was when I realized that I wouldn't want my boss telling me how to do it, that I stopped telling people how to do it and then asked them, how's it going to work? And looking at their solution, and if it would work, even if my solution and approach might be better or quicker, just biting my tongue and saying, get on with it. Because if I give them away and they fail, then it's my fault. Because I've tried to give them a solution that they weren't comfortable with, that might ultimately, they might fail doing it my way, whereas if they do it their way, they're probably going to have a better chance of success.
Right. And you get a lot more brain power in the process.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, that's another thing you mentioned in the book. There's nobody as smart as all of us. And I think again, that comes back to that self-awareness of leadership. A lot of times when we become leaders, we sometimes assume that we have to be Captain Kirk, that we have to solve the problem, that we have to fight the monster on the planet. But actually, we're just in charge of a whole diverse, skilled organization, and we should pick the best people for the job. It's not our job to do everything. At all.
Right. It would be exhausting to do it all.
Sorry?
It would be exhausting to have to do it all.
And also as well, I can honestly tell you that with a lot of things, I was probably the least capable of any single thing that we needed to get done. There might not be anybody in the team that was as good as me overall, but on every single task, they could all do it as well, if not better than I could. So, And again, I think this comes, you haven't talked about this, but I think once you get that self-awareness, it allows you to recruit people who are better than you. If you don't have that confidence, you have to recruit people who are not as good because you feel threatened. And I've always tried to recruit people who are better than me, and then I don't have to do it. I can just pick the right person for it. But it requires a degree of confidence and being comfortable managing people who are better than you are.
Mm-hmm. That's true, and it goes to that piece about being able to not let your ego get in the way.
Oh yeah. The ego is it is a very interesting thing, and you talk about that. The I mean, we do need ego, but again, it's that the good and bad and what serves us best.
Right, I talk about the healthy ego, and that's the ego that helps you want to grow. It helps you strive to do your best and help others do their best. It's a healthy, you're right. It's something that we do need. And then I talk about the little ego or the unhealthy ego,
Yeah.
and that's the ego that's in fear that, well, somebody's better than me, and what is this going to say about me, or someone's going to take my job, or and it's very, it holds others back and it holds yourself back as well. So
Yeah.
to be able to notice when your ego is getting in the way, your unhealthy ego.
Yeah, when I'm working with teams and trying to develop leaders, what I try and tell them is that you have to think of yourself as a conductor in an audience, in an orchestra, and
Right.
it's okay if everybody can play the instrument better than you because that's not your job. Your job's to
Right.
conduct the orchestra. The fact that they can play the violin better than you, that's a good thing because that's not
Right.
your job. Your job's to conduct. And
Right.
be comfortable that you're able to conduct the best musicians, because that's how you'll get the best music.
Right. That's a great example because you certainly probably don't even play every single instrument, so it takes them all of those instruments to make a beautiful symphony.
I think the instrument I play was decommissioned 20 years ago. I don't think anybody even plays it or wants to hear it anymore.
Was it?
So, that's why you need to have that comfort to be able to, conduct and, be humble that other people are going to be better than you, and that's okay. That
Absolutely.
it's. It's in fact, it's not only okay, it's absolutely necessary, because if you are the best at everything in your team, you can't grow over time. You can't make things better because you're now the limit. It can only be as good as you.
That's a very good way to put it. So to be able to look at the possibilities that the point of hiring top talent and bright, brilliant people is to see what they can do to contribute. And if you've put a ceiling on it or a lid on it and they're not able to contribute, then you can't get past that ceiling.
Yeah, and they're gonna leave pretty quickly.
Absolutely.
There's,
Absolutely.
you
There are many organizations that are looking for that brilliant talent.
correct. You can always get bottom quartile talent. That's always available. But if you've got top talent and you're not treating it and giving it the scope it needs, it'll look to leave, and there will be always people ready to take your best resources away from you.
Right.
And then one of the other things you talk about in the book, which I think is massively important, it is blame. And I always feel it's tied to accountability. If you take accountability, you're not in blame mode. But if you get in blame mode, then you're almost giving up your accountability. What's your thoughts on blame, and how do we stop that as leaders?
Sure. Blame is, well, again, one of the main concepts of overall concepts of my book is that this is an individual responsibility to be self-aware.
Yeah.
So if we're blaming someone else for the state of our career or the team or whatever, and not having any accountability to see what we're contributing or not contributing, then you're not going to get anywhere because you can't see past your own wall.
Yeah.
And blame it's a very negative energy. It's either comes from being afraid of taking accountability or responsibility for something.
Yeah.
And that ego getting in the way. And if all of these things are happening, then you're not moving forward and the team can't move forward.
Yeah, and I think blame, it just kills accountability. If you get into a situation where you're blaming everybody, and if you blame people for your own failings, then you can never fix it because you've given up responsibility. And if you blame other people, people aren't going to want to work for you. Nobody's going to volunteer for anything because if it goes wrong, they're going to get blamed for it. It creates I think it's probably one of the most corrosive ingredients that you can bring to an organization. It kills engagement. It kills motivation and morale faster than anything.
I agree with you. I agree.
So what can we do to get out of blame? What's your top tip for not blaming?
I think the thing is to look at why you won't take accountability. And usually I go back, I think fear comes back into the equation more often than we're willing to allow seeing that it does.
Yeah.
Because why do you need to blame this? And why won't you take responsibility? There's some fear there, more than likely. Fear that you won't be seen as the leader that you want to be. Fear that you made a mistake. Fear that you will have to take responsibility. And so there has to be that willingness. There has to be that intention and commitment to self-responsibility and to look at it. But if that is not there, it's really hard to shift out of blame.
Yeah.
So look at the beliefs, look at the behaviors, see why they're stopping you. And if you honestly want to see, you will discover. And then once you know what you're dealing with, whether it's an old belief, an emotional reaction, a true fear that maybe you'll lose your job.
Yeah.
Then you know, then you've got something that you can work on and do something about.
Yeah.
It's paralyzing to stay in blame for more, not just for you, but for others.
Yeah, I think one other thing with blame as well that people don't realize is it's not a solution to anything.
I mean, exactly.
If you're the leader, I remember my boss telling me, one of my bosses telling me that, you're accountable for this, gun, and if it goes wrong, it's your fault. And I thought, you report to the CEO. The CEO doesn't know my name. if you think the CEO is going to leapfrog you to complain to me, I don't think you understand hierarchy. An organization. And that's not to say it won't be my fault, but I report to you. You're accountable for success. If we fail, then if I fail, you fail. If I succeed, you succeed. So we're in this together. But people often just don't see that, and as you say, I think it just comes from fear and they start lashing out, and it's massively, massively corrosive.
Right.
So the last chapter of your book is about confidently leading yourself and leading others. So talk to us about leading yourself, because I'm guessing if you can't lead yourself, you can't lead others.
Right. Well, we are leading ourselves. We just might not be doing it very effectively. And so that, when we do it effectively, there's an inner confidence. There's you're aligned with your values, and you can see that you make decisions that are aligned with your values, which you have to know what those are to begin with, and that's another exercise to list your core values.
Yeah.
And when you are doing that, and I believe that if you are looking at all the different concepts that we've talked about that we cover in the book, then you are having a deeper awareness. And when you can't change what you don't know, you can't grow something that you don't know what it needs to nourish it. And so that inner accountability, that inner deeper awareness, that commitment, because chances are when you do the exercise to identify what your values are, there are at least one, if not more, or all of them, that do align with the inner desire to contribute, to give, to be authentic,
yeah,
and to make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And unfortunately, we don't have enough time to go into the values, and that is a very valuable piece for people to do. But it's not that's not a 10-minute journey either. That's almost as big as the conscious leading. I've done a lot of work on my own values, and I think as well, once we've identified what our values are, we can't stop there, because as we get older, our values change as well. And
absolutely,
you know, it's one of your values is security, once you become secure, it kind of drops down the list a little bit. And we need to, as you said, we need to understand them to know who we are, and lead ourselves, which then helps us lead others. So, Rosalie, it was an absolute pleasure having you on the show. I learned an awful lot. And can you tell us where people can find out more about you, what your website is, and where they can buy the book?
Absolutely. And thank you. It has been a pleasure being on the show with you. I appreciate it. And I've learned from you as well. My website is RosalieChamberlainConsulting.com. And the book is Conscious Leadership in the Workplace, a guidebook to making a difference one person at a time. Yep. It is available both in paperback and ebook on Amazon and also Barnes & Noble. And several other, it's also available from my website. And there are smaller bookstores around, but those are the main ones that I think most people probably have access to.
Okay, well, before you go, if people want to make an improvement in their conscious leadership, what's the thing they should start doing?
To make a commitment that I want to know more about myself and how effectively I'm leading, what are the beliefs I hold, and how do they impact my decisions, those I lead, and my life and the organization? We have to start looking at those.
Start looking inside first and then understand.
It's about self-awareness.
Okay, cool. So we start with self-awareness. Well, thank you for being on the show, Rosalie. It's been an absolute pleasure having you.
Thank you. Likewise. And have a wonderful day.
So I'd like to thank Rosalie for being on the show today. I thought we had some great information about how we can look to improve ourselves and become much more conscious leaders. As Rosalie said, we need to understand our values, and this can take time, but we need to be conscious, because the more conscious we are, the more authentic we can be, and the better a leader we can be, and a better also time that our teams are going to have with us. If you want to find out more about Rosalie, you can check her out on her website at www.rosaliechamberlainconsulting.com, and you can find her book, Conscious Leadership in the Workplace, on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble, or you can find it on her website. So thanks, Rosalie, for a great talk. It was massively informative, and I certainly learned an awful lot, and know that I have a lot more to do in order to become a much more conscious leader. If you enjoyed today's show, please leave a note, and if you've got any comments or suggestions on topics for future shows, please email me at gordon@gordontredgold.com with any comments, suggestions, or show ideas. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll tune in next time.